I'm sorry we didn't try the door. It might have been open, although church doors were not open in those days. Or even banged on the door. Maybe somebody might have come. But it was such an unlikely thing. That's what captured my imagination. So we pressed on for the rest of the night, and when it became daylight, there was one house we looked in underneath the house. It was closed in. We thought we might be able to hide in there, but the little door to the, I guess it was his woodshed under the house, was on a bit of a slope ground. I don't remember now why we didn't do it. I think probably we couldn't get in, or else there was no real protection. We were on the outskirts of a little village, and there was a church there. We went in. That church was open, but that wasn't getting us anywhere either. It was just a little place. It was no bigger than, oh, 15 by 20 feet. Like, it's just a little village place that satisfied the needs of that little community. And we're going over the hill, and down the other side we see a place at the on the side of the road, gendarmerie. And we had been led to believe that you couldn't trust the French police, which was a pity, because we turned around and went the other way and ran right into the Wehrmacht Feldpolizei. Now, that was Gamesville. They stopped and said, "Who are we?" And we had to, I realized then the story we gave them was so lame, it was ridiculous. I don't know who they thought we were going to fool with that tale. And so they just, now they were on a motorcycle with a sidecar. We were only a matter of 100 yards from that police station. I guess we must have walked up. I don't remember how we got up to the police station. They told the police to hold us until he came with a car. And after they left, it took them about an hour. And the policeman said, "It's too bad you didn't come in here first. We could have got you across." He had needed little tales like that at that time. But they came after an hour and drove us back to Besançon in the jail there. We got there just in time for soup, which I liked. I thought that was pretty nice. I sure needed it. It wasn't bad soup either. It was a little watery, but it, like vegetable soup. And I was just going to lie down. They came and got us, took us away again. They took us to Nancy. I have to go over these names now. I have to think about it. I haven't done this. I think I was 6 weeks in a civilian prison, so I think it must, I'm trying to think whether it was in Vesoul or whether it was in Besançon. I think it was in Vesoul. Front Stalag 194 was in Vesoul. No, I couldn't have been. I was either in Nancy or Besançon. I think it was in Besançon. Yes, it was, because when they finally did move us from that civilian prison, they took us back to the same bus station we left from. Yes, it was in Besançon, the civilian prison. And we got sort of a brief interrogation by a couple of people. I think it was the sergeant in charge of registering people coming in. And he was one of these watery, blue-eyed, quivery-chinned fellows that, he looked a lot like Himmler. Struck me as that type of fellow that, and he lashed out rather severely. He was most displeased with us because we told him we were Allied airmen, and of course it was terror fliegers and the usual stuff. But there's no, oh yeah, he said, "What's the matter? Are you afraid?" Well, by this time I was shaking so much I couldn't hold still. I was just vibrating all over. I said, "No, I wasn't cold." I said I was cold, but I wasn't. I wasn't even thinking properly at this stage.
You were exhausted.
Hmm?
You were just exhausted.
Oh, absolutely. And It was only a matter of a day. The next day, we were in the ushered into our permanent digs at Besançon jail. Different cells. We weren't in the same cell together. And I was in there with, it varied from time to time. There was an old man who'd been in the First World War. There was a young fellow, he was 21, newly married, used to cry all the time. Used to, you know, myself, what the, I said, what are you in for? He said, nothing, I didn't do anything. They just had a roundup, which they did from time to time, and in the hopes that somebody would, you know, that they might catch somebody. And then if they figured, oh, this guy's all right, they'd keep him in for maybe 2 or 3 weeks just to sort of let him know that not to fool around in the future. But he would, he'd cry in the morning, he'd cry at night, and he'd weep about his wife and all this. And I thought to myself, the old man isn't crying. And there was a 17-year-old boy came in at one point, and they shot him the next day, and he didn't cry. I could have kicked this guy. Anyway, he did one nice thing for me, though. When he left, he gave me socks, which I needed. I don't know where I got the fleas. Somewhere in there. Then there was a communist, bearded fellow. And he'd shout me down. I couldn't think fast enough in French to keep up with him. And I accused him of using the same tactics in his political endeavors as he's using in here. We talked about expediency justifying, or the means justifying the end and all this sort of stuff. And I said, you and I might as well quit talking, because we don't even agree on definitions, let alone anything else. So that, but he was, actually he wasn't all that terrible. And he knew somebody on the outside that used to bring him in jugged hair in a jar. Oh, that was good. I could forgive a lot of sins for that. Our rations were just a cup of ersatz coffee in the morning, a lump of bread. The French had good bread. I guess they grow quite a bit of wheat in France. And it was like whole wheat bread now that we see today. It was quite palatable. The Belgian bread was worse than the German bread. It was thick and heavy and doughy and indigestible. But the French was nice, light, risen bread. And we got a portion of a loaf. I think it was a seventh of a loaf a day. And a bowl of soup at noon. And that was it. And the next morning, you get a cup of this ersatz coffee.
What did you get in the evening?
I don't recall getting anything in the evening. You just had it. But the soup was so watery. And it, and there used to be a lot of these, look like lima beans or one of the dried lentil-type things that are mealy when you eat them. And I found that after I'd been there about 2 weeks, I couldn't do up my pants anymore. I was getting a bloated stomach. I thought, well, one thing I don't need is all this water. And I had very little nourishment in it, I presume. Anyway, when I used to do push-ups and sit-ups and stuff like that, and finally I found I couldn't do it anymore. But then pace, I used to do a lot of pacing. They wouldn't let you lie down during the day. You couldn't lie on the bunk. And there were four of us in a one-man cell, so that meant we at night we laid on the on one blanket. We had two blankets, one on the floor, one on the top of us. And I don't like sleeping in close quarters with three other men, so I, before anybody could say anything, I took one edge. So and then you lie like a plank because you don't even touch these guys. They didn't seem to mind though. They probably slept like that at home.
Were you allowed out at all?
Oh no way. Forget that. Exercise in the courtyard, nothing doing. They had a pipe that ran the length of the building through the cell right underneath the window, and it would be about 6-inch diameter. They used to put heat through that once a day for an hour. And I never tried washing in my clothes because you couldn't take them off, but I had two handkerchiefs. I was very lucky. I used to, we had a, the Doniker was a great piece of pipe, I guess about a foot in diameter, and it just went through the floor. That was it. There was no flushing or anything. And there was a funny little tin basin type deal with a pipe out of it running into that thing, and one tap. So you did have, I don't know if the water was safe to drink or not. I never did drink it. But I could rinse out my handkerchiefs and put them on that pipe when the heat went through. And it would dry, and then I had something. At least I had a clean handkerchief twice, or two clean handkerchiefs every day, even if I didn't use them. Funny the things that you cling to when you get down like that. And you put your shoes out at night, and you get them back in the morning. Well, mine didn't make much difference whether I had them or not. They were pretty well shot. And the window was so high, you could reach it, your fingers, all right, and you shin yourself up, look out the door. But if they ever caught you doing that, they came in and stuck the nightstick in your ribs pretty hard, so it wasn't really worth it. If you really wanted to have a lookout once in a while, you get one of the guys to stand before the little peephole. But you couldn't do that for very long, and you'd have to listen. You can hear the guard shuffling around. This little plate would rattle, and you could get down before any problem. You could talk to your next cell by getting right down where the pipe went through the wall, because the plaster kind of broke away a little bit. And when that communist got his jar of jugged hair, we ate it in the evening after our shoes had gone out and they turned out the light. I don't remember. Yeah, they had a light because you turn it on and look through the hole every once in a while during the course of the night. In the daytime, they didn't have it on. But the scraps that are left, the bones from this hair, we must have had other little goodies come in on occasion too. But he put them in a heap at the edge of the door, and in the morning when they opened up the door, you reached out, you grab your shoes and a sweeping brush and a dustpan, and you'd go over this, and they'd come back in a few minutes and with a bucket, and you'd dump your sweeping into there, just a little dust, you see, unless you're lucky enough to have some bones. And we put the bones out, and in the night the rats came, they'd run right across you. That didn't bother me at all. I didn't figure they were going to bother me. They wanted the bones, and they did. They ate every last scrap. There wasn't a thing left. And then you could hear scurrying back and forth. And I think if I'd got much hungrier, I'd have grabbed one of the little stinkers, because they weren't small. They were a pretty good size. But I would say maybe four or five of them. So I don't think I'd appreciate it that much now, because I know how dangerous they can be as far as disease is concerned. Maybe that's where I got the fleas. Anyway, and on Sunday, that was good. I like Sunday because I knew I wasn't going anywhere good. These guys hated Sundays because they never let anybody out on a Sunday. And one day they came and they let this 21-year-old guy out. That's when he gave me his socks, and he went home. And then one day they let the old man out, and I think somebody else came in. And one day they came for me. And I thought, uh-oh, you never know if these things are good or bad. And they put me, that cell wasn't all that clean. And I went to solitary. But I didn't mind that, because I wasn't with all these Frenchmen. And when I went into this new cell, it had all been scrubbed out with Lysol, and it was spotless, and it was, you could just smell the disinfectant, and I was in by myself. And when the food came around, the guy wouldn't stir the soup. He'd reach right down to the bottom and get all the good bits, and on Sunday, you get jam. See, what you do is you hold out your piece of bread. You just get one spoonful, and I'd have my soup tin and my bread like this, and when the fellow was giving me the jam, I would look at the guy with the soup, still holding my bread out there in case he wanted to throw a little more jam on there. And as soon as I felt that going on, the guy started to serve the soup, then I would look at the guy with the jam, and it worked very well. They had discovered that Ron and I were soldiers, and that were German defaulter soldiers that did the chores in the prison. So they were in jail too, so they could sympathize with us, and that's where we got, for that place, we got first-class treatment then. More grub in the soup and a little extra jam on Sunday. That's why I like Sundays, because you got the jam. Those guys didn't like it because they didn't get anywhere. They got two little candies about 2.5 inches long and about as big as, about the size of a cigarette on Christmas. It was taken 2 days before Christmas, so I got there in time for the Christmas party. These two little things, they were chocolate covered, and whatever it was inside was quite tasty. That's the only time I ever knew the Germans give you anything for a holiday, except a thick ear. Plus your jam ration, because Christmas was not on a Sunday. So you did okay then. And after we'd been verified by Dulag Luft, they had taken our identity cards. I held on to my dog tags. No, I did not. Correction. I gave them to people in Belgium because I got one of them back this summer. And I didn't take it. I gave it back. I said, you've held it for 40 years. You keep it for the rest of the time. I don't need it anymore. And she didn't really want to give it back anyway. She thought she should. No, but I did keep my I-card, my RCAF I-card. And they processed it through Dulag Luft, found out that a fellow by my description was missing from one crew. And
sorry, what is Dulag Luft?
Dulag Luft was the reception prison camp for Allied airmen. It was situated in Frankfurt on Main, and all downed aircrew funneled through this place. And then from there, you went to Dulag transient camp, which was nearby, and from the transient camp, when they made up a load, then you went out to one of the Stalag lifts, whether it was one or three for officers or six for the enlisted men, or some of the others that I didn't know about, Moosburg and 8B, I think, had quite a few airmen in it, but this was their way of routing it. Now, when I got to Dulag Luft, I didn't realize how lucky I was.
Could I just ask you a question here? This implies that they were maybe in touch with the British through the Red Cross, so the British would notify the Red Cross which airmen were missing?
No way. They wouldn't do that.
I don't understand.
Oh, no, you see, they captured the rest of my crew. So they said, where's this last guy? And it would not have been hard for them to put it together. They knew, they were very artful in putting two and two together, some from actual espionage, others from talking to the guys. I mean, there's no big deal. You say that a fellow by the name of Masters was in the crew. This may have happened. I don't know. To be specific, I cannot say how they knew that I was a member of that crew. In fact, come to think of it, maybe I do. We arrived there because we had identification, and I looked like my picture, and it looked like a Canadian document. I'm assuming that they got in touch with Dulag Luft and said, send him up, I think we need him. They may not have. They may have just said, when can we send this fellow? We've got an airman, and they sent me up there. But when I was interrogated there,
At Dulag,
a chap came in, Wehrmacht officer, and he spoke beautiful English, Oxford. Just, it was a delight to hear it again. And he said, we need to confirm that you are who you say you are, and also to notify the Red Cross. He said, you, in order to do that, you must tell me the names of your crew. And I wasn't about to do this, name, number, and rank. And he said, don't be silly. He said, you've been out of circulation for quite a while. And he said, there's nothing you know that we're interested in. We know more than you do now, because as far as that's concerned, you're of no use to us. But, he said, if we can't positively identify you by you telling us the other members of your crew, you'll go back to the Gestapo. And I don't think you want that. So I gave him the names of the crew. He said, by the way, he said, you are allowed to do this. He said, I'm not stuffing you full of a lot of nonsense. He said, if you have evaded or have been delayed in any way coming up here, it is permissible for you to give us the names of your crew to identify them. I found out afterwards he was right, but I didn't know it. But I thought the only one I could harm doing that was myself. Those guys are long gone. And so I told them. Next day I was gone. Transient camp. But I would have been gone. He wasn't kidding when he said that I was going to the Gestapo. And that was a crucial point in my career there. And I only found that out this summer. That they were looking for me particularly. Not just for any Allied airmen. They were looking for Bob Masters. And the reason for that was that they had discovered that I had been aided by Fruithof and Ludo van Eek and that crowd. And they were picked up just about the time I got to Dulag Luft. Around March of 44, they were picked up. And that would be about when I got to Dulag. Maybe early March, late February, but certainly not into April. And they were picked up because they had helped me. Not because they might have done anything else, because they didn't know about that, but they did know about me because of this Geraldine business, which I told you about. And had they only known to check with Dulag, they would have caught me right there. They wouldn't even have had to gone to the subsequent camp. And that one shook me, I'll tell you. That, to realize how close I came to winding up in a concentration camp, if, in fact, I'd even survived the interrogation, which I seriously doubt, because they would have known I had 6 months' names. I had more names than you could shake a stick at. Even today, I would be dangerous.
Why do you think they didn't check with Dulag?
God knows. I think possibly... This is a supposition. They may have thought that I got back to England. I just hadn't surfaced. I'd disappeared from the scene, and nobody had seen me. And Gestapo may not have ever asked. They didn't have any cross-check. If they'd had computers, I wouldn't have been there 10 minutes. So anyhow, then once you're in Dulag Luft, we went to the... the regime was very severe in the... In the interrogation center. It was a fairly new building, built strictly wartime. Everything was new. Everything was fairly cheap, the construction. The windows were all frosted, so you couldn't see out. Each room was separate, had a bunk and a thunder mug underneath it, and mine still had the Excelsior in it from the packing. It was that new. And every one of them had electric heat. And those great white pointed switches you used to have on electric stoves years ago, they had one of those outside each door. And their little trick was to turn them on, and you just swelter in there. You couldn't breathe. Well, you're supposed to use the thunder mug if you were not too pushed for that sort of thing. But if you really had a serious problem, well, you'd pull a little handle flag would drop down by your door, and a guard would come and take you down to the abort. So I couldn't stand it in here anymore. I didn't have to go, but I thought, well, I'm going to get out of here for a minute. So I pulled the flag, and he let me out in the hall. It was nice and cool. It was just great. And so I went down there, and I just walked back. He didn't stay with me, and he wasn't looking, and I just turned the switch off. He didn't notice it, and I got 2 or 3 hours sleep, and pretty soon it started to get hot again. I pulled the flag, and I guess the watch had changed. It was a different guy anyway, and it worked okay with him, and I got through the first night doing that. I guess I was there maybe 2 days. The food was good, very Spartan, very little food, but it was clean and the dishes were clean. And I think you got something 3 times a day, even though it was very meager. And then we went to the transient camp. Now, this was the first time I saw what a prison camp was going to look like, because it had the barbed wire, it had the huts, and you could wander around outside. This is the first time I've been able to do that since I had been captured, and meet other airmen. That was great. A whole bunch of guys that I could talk to that all spoke the same language. And we didn't talk too much about... We figured every other guy was a German in disguise, and we'd heard about the putting sleepers through and that sort of thing. But we were issued with a little cardboard suitcase about, 2 feet by 1 foot or 15 inches by maybe 6 inches. And in it was a sweater, a shaving outfit, a couple bars of soap, some cigarettes, but mostly clothing. And it had come through from the American Red Cross. They must have mass-produced these things by the hundreds, thousands. And everybody got one of those. And I can recall there were 2 types of sweaters. And it was that poor quality wool. I guess they couldn't do too well wartime. And these were all hand-knitted, and the people that knitted stuff for airmen and soldiers and that sort of thing back home, they'd send them to a Red Cross center, and they would, if you wanted to volunteer to knit sweaters, they would give you the pattern so that they had everything down pretty well pat. And I can remember after he had worn these things for about 2 weeks, the sleeves were, they didn't have cuffs on them anymore. They were about 8 inches in diameter, and the same with the, you know, they just went all out of shape. And there was one shoe manufacturer, I'd like to catch the guy that did it, because we could quite easily have given him a little treatment. They were the worst shoes I've ever seen in my life. And it must have cost them about 60 cents a pair. They didn't block the tops. They got a piece of thick leather, and then they got a piece of thin leather, and they just cut it to more or less shape and shaped it around. And there's so little room, you couldn't get your feet down the end of them. And these are supposed to, you know, you've got a captive audience, captive market. Boy, they sure stuck it into us in that, or stuck it into the Red Cross, because I'll bet they had a contract where they were making just nothing but bucks out of it. Because nobody in his right mind would even, you know, that they were just super terrible. So we were all waiting for the day when we got a set of issue boots, because I guess some of our own military people would, because they were I had a pair of RAF boots, which came through, I guess the RAF supplied them to the Red Cross. They didn't replenish uniforms. In fact, I don't know how we did for uniforms. I had an American, they must have had American and British clothing, now that I think of it, because I was given a pair of American Army uniform pants and an American greatcoat. Yeah. I don't remember where I got that stuff. When I was in the civilian prison, they gave us... My trip from Besançon jail to Dulag Woof was an interesting trip, too. I'd forgotten about it. I left out a whole great big chunk of it. They decided that Ron and I were to go. So they took us down to the bus station. We'd been confirmed as prisoners now. We're going to Dulag Woof. And this is in Besançon. And they took us to Front Stalag 194 in Vesoul. That was an old French army barracks, permanent. And where we were bunked down, Ron and I, was in a plastered horse stall. Like it was properly built, and the manger at the end was all built right into it, and in a very, very nice stable. And I guess there must have been maybe 10 or 15 horse stalls in this one portion. And at the end, they locked that off. And we were in there. We could go between the cells up and down the passageway at the end of the stalls. And there were a lot of Arabs in there that had been captured in North Africa. And I'd been given a pencil, I should say, with old beautiful pencil, gold pencil. I put it down. It didn't take an Arab but 2 seconds to get that. Got there quick. I was pretty upset about that. You know, I don't know what possessed me to have looked around. But being a prisoner in with French troops and Italian troops and the Arabs, and making a little fire down at the end of this place and a Mickey Mouse stove and what little food you had. They gave us bulk sausage and chunks of black bread and that sort of thing, and we did whatever we wanted to do with it. And somewhere along the line, Ron and I had been given some stuff by the Red Cross, French Red Cross, so we had a few little things. Not much. And we kept it in a pillowcase affair that we'd come by somewhere along the line. And we stored it on the manger was a piece of wood, like a piece of plywood that you could put your stuff on if you were going to put it down and let those guys at it. And every night there'd be a mouse. You don't think it was a rat. He didn't eat enough. But a mouse, maybe a couple of them. You'd be into this, eating holes in your pillowcase and taking a little. And I wasn't about to share with them. So I said to Ron, well, we can fix this guy. There was a hook in the deckhead right in the middle of this thing. And it's what? There's enough room in the width of there. There are two narrow cots, and you could just get your legs between them to walk past them. That's all, but that's maybe 5 feet. 5 feet wide, and right in the center was a hook, and we went up. I think I must have lifted him up or vice versa. Anyway, we got up so we could reach, and we tied our bag of goodies up there. And those little sods got up there. They must have run up the wall and across, but they got in there. So we knew where they were coming in. So I said, okay, Ron, let's block it off. And we blocked it off, and they'd eat their way through this thing. So I said, okay, I got one more plan. I said, let's get a little piece of crust, not too much, less than they normally eat. Put it down the hole, then put a rock down there, and then put this board on it. Maybe when he can't, it's easier to eat that than it is to eat the board. And maybe he eats a little bit, he won't be so hungry, he won't have the enthusiasm to eat through the board. And you know, it worked. But if we didn't put anything down there, he'd get through the board. Crazy. We were interrogated at this place. A front stalag, by the way, is called front to designate that it's in an occupied country. And they didn't like to keep white troops there. That's why there were so many Arabs and a few black guys. Because if they escaped and they got out into the town or anywhere, they'd stand out like a sore thumb and they're easy to round up, so they didn't have to worry about it. And a lot of the fellows were trustees. They'd go into the village for whatever purpose. We still had some money, too, as I recall, from our escape kit. Because when we came out of the civilian prison, they gave us back our stuff that they'd taken from us. You know, the pencils and belts and shoelaces and all that stuff. And we haven't yet arrived at Dulag Luft now. This is on the way. So we were interrogated by the Gestapo at that camp by a fellow that didn't speak English. And they got an official translator there. And he didn't speak very much English, but it wasn't bad. But he was a professor of languages at the University of Paris. And he tried to speak to me in English. Ron and I were both taken up and put in a little room, and they took me out first and interrogated me, and then when they finished with me, they had him in there. And he's going through my stuff, and there was a key in there, and he says, "What's the key for?" I said, "That's for my motorbike." "Ah, oh, you have a motorbike. What kind you got?" Well, we started talking about motorbikes. And he was no Gestapo man, as I say. He's just doing the translating, and he's just an old school teacher. He was a nice old guy. Anyway, he'd start asking me questions, and there was a girl there taking notes, or shorthand, in three languages. Incredible. And this Jerry officer was getting so upset because he could see that we weren't really getting down to business, because every time he'd ask me a question, it was getting a little close to the meat. I'd no problem picking him up on an error in English. And I remember one of them was, "When you leaped from your when did you spring from your aircraft?" And I said, "Spring." Now that's an interesting translation of the, what was it, saute, to jump? I've forgotten myself. Anyway, I said, there are two or three. You can jump, you can leap, or spring, as you said, but I go into, you know, if you're going to dive off a diving board, it's, you could, you know, and now I went into all this detail, and he's eating it up. And this officer got so mad one time, I thought he was going to have apoplexy. He couldn't handle enough English to get it out. And he says, "We know more than you think. We have knowledges and informations the English." I thought, great, you're no real threat as long as you stay like this. But he made such a fool out of himself, stomping around, not really getting it out, and the veins on his head were just sticking out like bits of rope. And then he stormed out. I never saw him again. Well, we finished this whole great big long thing, and every time he got close to the bone, as I say, I'd deter him in one way or another. And somehow or other he got the idea I got shot down 3 days before, and I never did anything to change his mind. "Well, where did you spend the night before you were picked up?" "How the hell would I know?" I said, "I never hear in my life before. The only thing I know about Paris is they got the Eiffel Tower there." And I remembered that remark because afterwards, Ron had his interrogation, then we went back, and 2 days later they called us back, put us in the same room, took me in, read the whole statement to me, and everything I said was in there. Every last word. That gal had done the whole thing, done a beautiful job in all the languages that had been spoken. I don't know if anybody translated it for the German officer. Now, he probably, again, maybe he was so fed up he didn't want to bother with these guys. Maybe that's how I got lucky. Anyway, he handed it over for me to sign. I said, "I'm not going to sign that." "But you must." I said, "I don't must." I said, "What would my people do when the war is over and they come in there and find this document and I've signed all that gibberish and all I'm supposed to tell you is my name, number, and rank?" I said, "I've told you, you've got it. My signature on it is going to make no difference whatever." Oh, well.